This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear a speech by Vivek Chivers, professor of sociology at NYU. It's titled Imperialism in the American Century. We'll also talk about how the military recently accused two lawyers for Guantanamo detainees of smuggling underwear to their clients. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We go now to listen to a speech recently recorded at the Brecht Forum in New York while honoring Professor Harvey Goldberg. Speaker Vivek Chivers is a professor of sociology at NYU and the author of Locked in Place, State Building and Late Industrialization in India. His speech is titled Imperialism in the American Century. Vivek describes what progressives can expect in the near future in terms of basic principles of justice and how the project for the new American century helped shape U.S. imperialism. Let's have a listen.
What I'm going to talk about today is not so much the 20th century. The lecture was entitled The American Century, Imperialism and the American Century. And what I wanted to talk about, because it's what every progressive today thinks about, is really the debacle that we see unfolding in the Middle East today, the enormous human suffering that the United States is directly responsible for, and what we can expect in the near and in the distant future for just basic principles of justice and a basic chances for people to lead decent lives who have had the misfortune of having been born in lands that the United States deems its own. And towards that, what I would like to do then is start with a perspective on where the invasion of Iraq falls in the stream of American foreign policy, what the driving forces behind it were, to allow us to get some bearings on what to expect now that it's clearly a sense of defeat for the United States, and there is a strong sense that some alternative, some change is now called for. The ascension of Bush has provided an easy identification when we think about this debacle of the invasion of Iraq with one particular cabal, and that is the neocons who've had such a strong position inside his administration. There's a popular belief, not just in the mainstream but also in the left, that this whole drive, this thrust into Iraq was driven by the neocons and the project for the new American century, and the Democrats have essentially had to react to it. And now that they have, as they like to say, created their own reality, the Democrats are caught a prisoner of the mess that the Republicans have created and find very little way of getting out of it. In this whole dynamic, the explosion that's occurred in the Middle East now is associated with a narrow band within the American ruling class, and the rest of the ruling class is seen as being held essentially prisoner to this. Well, to what extent is this true? Because what we predict about the future depends largely on how deep we think the consensus around the invasion of Iraq goes within American ruling circles. And in all such matters, I think it's always useful to take a look at history just a little bit to get some perspective on where this invasion came from, on what set of interests were driving it, and whether or not it represents an aberration, a departure from the pattern of American foreign policy, or whether it fits into that stream. Where we come down on this has a direct bearing on where we think we're going to go in the future. Now, as it happens, the younger Bush's administration comes at a time when it should be, history has provided us with some material to actually get a pretty good sense of whether or not it's an aberration or whether it's a product of deeper forces within the American ruling circles. Because Bush II came to power after 8 years of a Democratic administration, and that Democratic administration in turn came to power at a moment which ought to have been a watershed in American foreign policy, and perhaps a time for deep changes within American foreign policy, because that moment at which Clinton came to power was one which occasioned the fall and the demise of the Soviet Union and all of its satellites. So it's sort of the 90s presented us with a kind of natural experiment to see if the demise of the Soviet Union, which was always taken to be a source of fundamental direction of American foreign policy, if that actually triggered changes within the policy, and if so, how deep they were. Because on the conventional story of the Cold War, everything should have changed when the Soviet Union fell, at least with regard to American foreign policy. You'll recall that the decades of American aggression abroad, the use of terror, the use of violence, the sponsoring of torture chambers and death squads, all of that was justified as basically a defensive strategy, a strategy that was drawn up not as the expression of an American desire or will to expand into the world, but as an expression to contain another expansionist force, and that was the Soviet Union. It was basically a defensive strategy which was supposed to have been then rendered obsolete when the evil empire disappeared. Well, what happened in the 90s, of course, was quite the opposite. Far from America withdrawing and scaling back its international ambitions, right at the outset of the decade, what you witnessed was the first Bush, Bush the Elder, declaring that this was going to be now a new global order and launching a war in the Gulf against that very man, Saddam Hussein. And bookending the decade, 9 years later, Bill Clinton presiding over the bombing of Serbia in order to preserve the viability and, more importantly, American position within NATO in explicit defiance of the United Nations. This was a decade, then, in which the United States, far from withdrawing from its imperial ambitions, seemed to actually pursue them with greater vigor and greater boldness. Now, the strategy behind this actually was enunciated fairly clearly. First in 1992 by Paul Wolfowitz in an act which has come to be known as the Wolfowitz Indiscretion, which is 1992 when he was supervising the annual overview of defense strategy. Wolfowitz laid out a policy statement which got leaked to the press and shouldn't have, of course. It did, however, in which he laid out a program with a very bold agenda for American expansion abroad, in which the military and the economic would play equally powerful roles. Mere 1 year later, after Wolfowitz had been disgraced and the Bush administration had publicly forsworn any such ambitions, Clinton's National Security Advisor Anthony Lake gave a speech at Johns Hopkins in September of 1993, the title of which was very important. It was called American Foreign Policy: From Containment to Enlargement. This laid out, much as Wolfowitz had, an ambition, an agenda for American expansion abroad. And what was significant about it was that even though it did not, having learned his lessons, explicitly make a call for American military might to be used as a lever, it also did not make any mention of two of the main pillars of what liberals in the Democratic Party had been pushing for in the 90s for American foreign policy, which is arms control and greater use of diplomacy and peace treaties. He made no mention of that. The only thing that he committed to was an enlargement of American influence abroad. Well, this gave an indication of what was in store for the rest of the decade from both parties, the Republicans as well as the Democrats. Now, there is one respect, I think, in which Lake's talk and the title were misleading. There's no doubt that the United States was committed to a policy of expansion and enlargement, power projection, as the Defense Department would like to call it. But it was misleading to suggest that there was a transition from something called containment to enlargement. Containment was the little bit of jargon, the little nomenclature that was used by the policy establishment and also mainstream intellectuals, the intelligentsia and the media, to describe American foreign policy during the Cold War, which was taken to be, as I said earlier, a defensive posture against Soviet expansionism. But in point of fact, America during the Cold War had had very little concern for actual containment as they described it. The entire Cold War era, American foreign policy during that era, was driven itself by a very strong expansionist current. Indeed, you can look at the entire 20th century and American foreign policy during it as a progressive expansion of American power abroad, the tempo of which was determined by the extent to which there were constraints organized internally and externally, which slowed down that process of expansion. And here we can look at two real watersheds in that process. The first occurred with the Second World War. During the interwar period, during the 20s and 30s, when the United States emerged as a world power, there were two constraints externally to the boldness and the ambition with which it could extend abroad. The most important one was not the Soviet Union. The most important one was other capitalist powers. And this was the colonial empires of England and France, which had control over large parts of Asia, Southeast Asia and South Asia, Africa and the Middle East. The Second World War provided the occasion for the dismantling of this particular set of constraints. And this is an important point. The planning for American expansion into these areas which had been blocked off by European colonial powers, that planning began not after the war ended, but days into America's entrance into the war. Literally days after Pearl Harbor, when the United States announced its entrance into the war, Roosevelt put together a vast network of planning agencies in the State Department, especially, the mandate of which was to devise a strategy for the post-war era which would be based on America prying open markets and military spheres of influence in the very areas that England and France were influential in. Now, the important point here is this was done before the outcome of the war could be known. Indeed, it was done even before Germany had even invaded Russia. What happened after the war, then, was that the United States acted on an agenda knowing that the end of the war, no matter what else happened, the end of the war would be characterized by a severe weakening of European powers as they got done killing each other. The second important point about this, then, is that as the U.S. expanded into this world, it is given that it was acting on a plan that was put into place in the early 1940s. It's impossible to say that it was a reaction to Soviet aggression. It was actually the implementation of an agenda that had been laid out starting 6 years before the war actually ended. Really, you can trace it back to 1939. So what happened during the 40s and 50s then was an expansion outward because one powerful constraint had been removed, and that was the European colonial empires. In the immediate aftermath of the war, it is true, the U.S. actually bolstered those empires. It sustained them. It actually gave them support because it was seen as necessary to Europe's recovery. But that support was given in a way that ensured that Europe would now be dependent on the U.S. for the survival of those empires. And by the 60s, Europe was being pushed aside. What happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s then was the U.S. spread into new areas constrained now by one power, which was the Soviet Union. But here again, it's important to note two things. The first is that the Soviets were extremely cautious in how they dealt with the United States. And for most of what is known as the Cold War, the U.S. actually didn't give much regard for Soviet reactions and responses to their policies in most of what is known as the Third World, because the Soviets followed a policy of very strong and very consistent appeasement of the United States. This started with Stalin, who during the 50s basically said, outside of Eastern Europe, you do what you want to do. Eastern Europe is ours. Stalin basically, for those of you who know history, his concern was Yalta. He was going to stick with the Yalta Agreement and beyond that, into Southeast Asia, in Latin America, even in the Middle East, Stalin played a very conservative foreign policy. Khrushchev followed this. Vietnam is the best example of this. The Soviets did everything short of actually joining the war against the North Vietnamese when it came to the Vietnam War. So first of all, the Soviets were basically following a very conservative policy with regard to the U.S. outside of Eastern Europe. Inside Eastern Europe, you couldn't mess with them. Outside of that, until 1979, they were very cautious. What 1991 represented then was the disappearance of the second set of constraints, and right after it, what does the U.S. do? Through the 90s, it establishes military bases in the two areas that had been closed off to it as long as the Soviets were around, Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So what happens during the 90s then is, for the first time now, the United States finds itself without any kind of rival empire, and it does exactly what it did in the aftermath of the Second World War, which it expands into areas which had been closed off to it. So the end of the Cold War was an opportunity, but it was not an opportunity for the U.S. to scale back. It was an opportunity to further its ambitions abroad. The Gulf War, the first Gulf, well, technically the second Gulf War, but the first war that the Bushes waged in the Gulf was a very dramatic announcement of just this ambition. And the bombing of Serbia was Clinton's announcement of the same ambition. Both were designed to extend American military power into these new areas. Well, what this tells you is that during the 1990s, there was a fairly deep consensus within the American foreign policy establishment that there was to be no revisiting the issue of whether the United States should dismantle, whether the United States should scale back, whether it should actually think about dissolving its militarism. It was understood that this was simply not up for grabs. That does not gainsay an important distinction, I think, which is that the Clinton administration, while it was not averse to using the military as a lever to extend its influence abroad, it nevertheless gave greater priority to economic globalization and the use of more purely economic instruments. The Clinton administration literally did believe that it's the economy, stupid, and Clinton, in a way that would please any Marxist, understood that the basic function of the state is to further the interests of American business. And the 90s was a period in which neoliberalism as an economic model was actually consolidated across much of the world. This was the decade of shock therapy in Eastern Europe. It was a decade in which Latin America basically, after experimenting in the 80s with some heterodox policies, switched in a very, very committed way to neoliberalism. India entered the neoliberal era in 1991, and China, this is when China greatly liberalized its economy. Clinton was fundamentally committed to the expansion of American corporate and financial interests abroad, and this is what he concentrated on. This fact, I think, is what has given some people the impression that the arrival of the younger Bush represented a very fundamental and important turning point, turning away from economic globalization towards a more militaristic policy, especially with regard to Saddam Hussein and Iraq. Recall that during the 90s, when Clinton was in power, Hussein was still around, but he was, as everybody admitted, contained. This is the word they used. That is to say, his regime was placed under a brutal regime of sanctions, which, while absolutely horrendous in its effects on the Iraqi population, killed off 500,000 of them, was nevertheless one which kept Hussein's military ambitions curtailed because of its inability to further develop the actual instruments of the military. The airspace was closed to him because the United States had imposed no-fly zones. The only planes using the no-fly zones were American bombers who, virtually on a weekly basis, were bombing the Iraqi population. And of course, so that Hussein's oil-producing capacity was greatly crippled because of economic sanctions, which disallowed corporations from entering the country. So from the standpoint of the foreign policy establishment, it appears like Hussein was not a problem at all. And when Bush comes to power in 2000, it seemed like a status quo that could be extended into perpetuity. Why then? Why then such an enormous push to invade? Even though there is a shared vision between the Democrats and the Republicans on American expansion abroad, the fact that the Bush turns to such an aggressive militaristic policy seems to be a shift away from the policy favored by the Democrats and the Clinton administration, which was more of an emphasis on economic instruments. Why does it happen? Well, the easy answer is the neocons. It was because Bush comes to power on the back of a very well-organized group And this group is ideologically committed to transforming the Middle East, whereas Clinton was basically committed to containing whatever threats there were in the Middle East while fulfilling his agenda in the rest of the world. Well, I think this, all it reflects really, in my view, is the amnesia of American political culture. Because the fact of the matter is that in the last 2 years of his administration, Clinton and his policy advisors had switched tracks when it came to Iraq and had committed themselves to a much more aggressive and militaristic posture, even with regard to Saddam Hussein. And indeed, in the last year of his policy, as I'll mention in a second, Clinton had actually given the green light to design some kind of regime change policy within Iraq, which did not exclude a military invasion. So why? What was it that brought Clinton to the same doorstep at which we find Bush 2 years later? I think it's the two or three important factors. First of all, there's a myth in the both the books that are coming out on Iraq and also especially the print media. There's a myth that Clinton was happy with containment when it came to Saddam Hussein. The fact of the matter is, nobody, not Bush the elder nor Clinton, saw containment as their first preference. Right from the start, regime change had been the first preference, both of Bush and of Clinton. And in fact, through the 1990s, you find the Clinton administration trying a variety of measures to depose Saddam Hussein, short of an invasion. They try what's called the Afghan option, which is cultivating a local resistance, some kind of militia, which is what they did against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. That's why it's given its name. Didn't work. They tried assassinations. The CIA didn't work. They tried instigating an army coup. Didn't work. 1996 is when they started it and then they pulled back. And the 10,000 Kurdish soldiers were basically left hanging high and dry. It didn't work. By the late years of the Clinton administration, the people, and there was a significant current within the administration, who were very committed to regime change, were running out of options. The only option that was basically left was an invasion. Now, there was still a powerful current that wanted the status quo to continue with the sanctions regime and containment. The problem was, and this is the crucial point, I think, this regime was breaking down by the late 1990s. It was breaking down for a couple of important reasons. Sanctions could only continue so long as the American political alliances within the UN and within the Middle East could sustain them. But these political alliances were coming under tremendous pressure, especially in Europe. One important reason for this is the weight of public opinion. The sheer brutality and the inhumanity of these sanctions was now very widely known. Madeleine Albright didn't help things when she declared on television that she thought the death of 500,000 Iraqis was worth it, the word she used. She said, yeah. She was asked, do you think it's worth it? And she said, yes. This televised her, but it also televised what was actually happening in Iraq. The willingness and the ability of European political elites to sustain the sanctions regime was eroding very, very fast. But equally, the economic side of it was also taking serious blows. There was a fundamental shift in the situation with international oil between the early 90s and the late. In the early 90s, taking Iraqi oil offline was not that much of a problem because through the 80s and into the early and mid 90s, the situation with regard to world oil supplies was they were plentiful, and in the Gulf especially, there was plenty of what's called spare capacity. That is to say, if demand temporarily outran supply, key swing producers within the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, could expand supply at a very rapid rate to meet expanding demand. In a report that came out of the Council for Foreign Relations and the Baker Institute in 2000, it was declared that at a world level, spare capacity in relation to world demand was now down to 2%, which meant that basically, unless there was a tremendous increase in supply through new exploration, the digging of new oil wells, the setting up of new rigs, world demand would start over a fairly middle-term time horizon start outpacing the production of oil. The problem was this. There were, in the 90s, two sites where you could have, where there was still serious potential for discovering new oil reserves. One was Central Asia, the Caspian Basin. And the second was in the Gulf, Iraq especially. In the early 90s, there had been tremendous optimism with regard to the Caspian Sea, Central Asia, that it would be a site for discovery of tremendous new oil reserves. By the late 90s, the oil companies were actually fairly pessimistic. It had not turned out to be the gold rush, the Klondike, that they thought it would be. The problem now was the only places where there existed new untapped reservoirs of oil supplies were in those countries where sanctions had made it illegal for oil companies to go in. And there was now there was pressure coming in from the oil companies for sanctions to be loosened at the very least, so that this is American oil company, so they can go into Iraq and Iran in order to get new contracts with them. But more importantly, oil companies from the rest of the world were actually cutting deals with Hussein already. By 2002, Hussein had more than 24 contracts that he'd signed with Chinese, Russian, French oil companies for the exploration of new fields. So what's happening is it's not just that American oil companies need to find new investment outlets and they're not being allowed to get them in the Middle East, it's that their competitors are getting them as well. There's a double pressure on them now. Adding to this was a final fact, which is that given that supplies at a world level were not increasing at pace with demand, it became an issue now for American national security as well. There was a real worry that the inability to increase supply and reserve capacity with the growth in world demand meant that there was now the possibility of wild swings in oil prices, what's known as greater volatility in oil prices. Normally, volatility in oil prices is mitigated by having lots of spare capacity so that you can increase and decrease supply as demand fluctuates up and down because of some kind of shock. Well, with supply basically now at almost full capacity, you run the possibility of wild fluctuations in prices of oil, which is a commodity that directly affects the stability of a good number of regimes, not only around the world, but regimes to which the United States is very closely tied. So here's what's happening then. Containment is breaking down because sanctions are not working. There's public support to dismantle them, and there's tremendous pressure from very powerful economic actors to undo them. And within the foreign policy establishment, it's now seen as something that's a general concern, not just a concern of one or two sectional interests like the oil companies. So people arguing for regime change within the Clinton administration, who in 93, 94, 95 were just one policy current, but could not bring other people to the table to their side, who lost out in arguments to people like Anthony Lake or the Dubs, like Clinton himself, Warren Christopher, who were saying that, look, he might be a problem, but we can handle him for now, and the regime of sanctions is working fine, that argument ceases to hold water. And the hawks now start to get an audience for the policy that they are actually advising, which is some kind of regime change. The problem is the avenues for regime change have run out. They've tried everything except the invasion. When Bush comes to power then, there is actually a very wide spectrum of opinion cutting across both parties, which says that there must be a fundamental change with regard to policy towards Iraq. Everybody, even the Dubs, say we have to be more aggressive. We have to use armed force more. We have to bomb him more. But now there's also a very deep wellspring of opinion which says we have to go beyond it. If we're serious about deposing him, we're going to have to actually invade. And this actually is in the Democratic and the Republican Party. The one option that's remaining is to dismantle the sanctions and just rely on the threat of violence. Just get rid of the sanctions. Just rely on the threat of violence to tell Hussein, if you step out of line, we'll just bomb the hell out of you. This allows the oil companies to go in. This takes pressure off the European allies. And it restores some kind of, it takes the pressure off the domestically for some kind of policy change. But this runs up against another problem, a political constraint, which is, if you allow Saddam Hussein to come out of this, He only comes out of it politically incredibly more powerful than he was when he went in.
You know, we're dealing with a very critical and crucial time. Most crucial and critical time that I've ever witnessed. Being as young as I am, you know. We all don't want to say nothing else, so we say as young as we are. Now I want to talk about the pronunciation and the realization. Now the educators, they call it ESP, positive thinking, right?
Speaker Vivek Chibbers is a professor of sociology at NYU. His speech is titled Imperialism in the American Century.
Saddam Hussein has now withstood one decade of assaults from the most powerful adversaries in the world. And he now becomes a beacon for all the forces in the Middle East that are lined up against American interests and American foreign policy over there. And in my view, what gives this additional leverage is that in 2000, the Second Intifada erupts in Palestine, in the occupied territories. And Saddam Hussein now, it's not that he's a great supporter of the Palestinians. He was as cowardly and as corrupt as the other Arab ruling classes when it came to actually supporting the Palestinians. But the problem is, America now appears weak in the region. And its historic role of scuttling any peace process, or at least using the peace process as a means of battening down control on the Palestinians in the occupied territories, it's now weakened. The ideal situation would have been what happened after the first Gulf War, which is right after it, when after defeating Hussein, Bush set into process what ultimately became the Oslo Accords, which was the most disastrous accords for the Palestinians. But it was done largely because of the enormous surge in power that the U.S. experienced with local elites in the Middle East. What was happening now is the opposite. The United States would have appeared weak. So here's the situation in which the Democrats and the Republicans find themselves in 2002. Saddam Hussein can no longer be ignored. All the foreign policy initiatives the U.S. is trying to do in the region and beyond, his name keeps popping up. The sanctions regime that was containing him is no longer working. But removing the sanction means only increasing his political visibility and viability and signing basically a kind of political and symbolic defeat for the United States in the region. The only way out of it, the only way to resolve both of these conundrums is to have him gone, have some kind of regime change. They are now, and this, let me just pause for a second. This is recognized across both parties. There are now two remaining constraints to this. The one crucial one is that nobody believes the American public will stand by, will actually allow an invasion of Iraq. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recognize this, the Democrats recognize this, the Republicans recognize this. The second constraint is a fear of what will happen if they actually invade. Invasions set off their own chain of events. Now we know. But there are two very powerful constraints. It's understood that if there's going to be an invasion, it'll have to be handled very, very carefully with a very solid alliance with local elites and with Europe, and it's going to require cooperation, not so much in the invasion. Everybody knew the invasion would be Americans. But in the post-invasion scenario. Well, this is where 9/11, on 9/11, Osama bin Laden handed the American policy establishment a gift. Because after 9/11, public opinion for the first time was pliable enough that one of these two fundamental constraints disappeared, or at least was loosened enough where you could contemplate actually going in. What remained was only the second one. And this was still something. The second constraint, worries, were still something. But this, I think, is where the neocons' importance arises. Whereas everybody else laid out all the imponderables and all the worries about what would happen if the U.S. went in, to those people who wanted to have some kind of workable strategy, a workable blueprint for the invasion, The neocons handed them one, full of all kinds of rosy scenarios, full of all kinds of predictions. Yeah? And this is where the battle between the hawks and the doves occurred, not on whether or not the U.S. should be aggressive, not on whether the U.S. should expand into the Middle East, all that was agreed upon, but simply on if we invade, and not also on should Saddam Hussein be deposed. This was agreed upon. There were a couple of voices I'll come to in a second who disagreed. But if you go back and you look at this, nobody disagreed with this. It was only on can we make it work? Can we make it work or can't we? The problem was there's a possibility it wouldn't work, but there was a window of opportunity that the change in public opinion had given the United States, and that window would not last forever. And fortune favors the brave. So in the debate that you see occurring in 2002 then, this is the issue. And mind you, the Democrats get on ball very, very quickly. The real opposition comes from the Republican side. The real opposition comes from people like Brent Scowcroft, people like Lawrence Eagleburger. But the Democrats don't oppose this. Bill Clinton goes on the air in the fall of 2002 and says, of course we should get rid of him. Just make sure you do it right. And the way you do it right, go through the UN and get a new resolution. And he basically says, make sure it's a resolution he'll never agree to. And once you get intrusive enough inspections passed by the Security Council, then when we know he's not going to go abide by them, we can go in. He should know this is what the Rambouillet Accords were before they started bombing Serbia. The Rambouillet Accords were set up so that there was no way Milosevic would ever agree to them. Clinton goes on the air and says this. Yeah? In September, when George Bush demands congressional approval for the invasion of Iraq, there is considerable opposition among liberal Democrats who are not convinced of all the spurious arguments about weapons of mass destruction, this, that, and the other. What happens in the Democratic Party before the vote? The leadership of the party swings into action to bring in the vote for the invasion. And not just any old Democrats, it is the chief brains between Clinton's foreign policy team. Who is it? Madeleine Albright? Dennis Ross, Richard Holbrooke, Kenneth Pollack, and Dick Gephardt. They hold a special closed meeting with Democratic congressmen, and they basically tell them, you've got to approve this. You've got to approve this vote. And they do. They pass it. On the Republican side, there is worry from people like Scowcroft, but this has been vastly exaggerated. Basically, what Scowcroft is saying is not that different from what Clinton is saying. What he's saying is, you've got to go in with an allied approval. And what he's really talking about is not the Europeans. He's really talking about the Middle East, Saudi, because these are the people who have to hold it together in the post-invasion scenario. Yeah? Now, in the intervening years, even now you see this, Scowcroft has achieved something of a mythic status, that this was the man, the sage counsel, who had predicted that it would be a disaster. And what he was saying was, look, we did it right the first time. When we went in the first Gulf War, we went in with our allies. This is how you should do it now. This is true, but there are 2 points to note. One, he never made it a condition for going in. He never said, if you don't get the approval, don't go in. He said, look, if you're going in, just get the approval. And secondly, and you'll appreciate this, Henry Kissinger pointed this out in September of 2002. When it was asked of him on CNN, I think it was, as to what he thought of Scowcroft's warnings, he simply rejected the premise. Kissinger said, I don't understand what Scowcroft is talking about when he makes reference to the first Gulf War. He said, what we did during the war was we didn't wait for our allies to approve of the American bombings to start. What we did was we made it clear that we were going to go in no matter what. And we gave our allies a choice. Either you can be standing on the sidelines and left out in the cold in the post-war dispensation, or you can jump on the bandwagon now. What Scowcroft was saying was simply this. He says, if you're going to go in, make sure you take these guys with you. And indeed, in retrospect, I think a fair case can be made that while there were elements in the Bush administration who wanted to have nothing to do with the UN, in the end, Bush went pretty far in following in his father's footsteps. The difference was this, I think. The difference was that whereas in the first Gulf War, there was reason for the Europeans to ally with him and go in, during the second Gulf War, during the invasion that Bush II launched, there wasn't. Their public opinion was just too strong. They couldn't do it. You remember Schroeder squeaked by in an election only for one reason. He was all the polls were showing he was going to lose. He simply, and at a very late hour, came to an anti-U.S. position, a position on American foreign policy, which elevated his ratings enormously. The latest discovery, that's the transcript of Bush's discussions with the Spanish prime minister, is it a prime minister or president, I'm not sure, lays this out very well. The fundamental concern of the Europeans was public opinion. So across both parties, again, there was a fundamental agreement that if we go in, we should go in with our allies. That was the only disagreement. And then, of course, once they went in, the debacle ensued. The point of raising all these issues is, I think, simply this. Of course, the invasion has been a calamity for the United States. And of course, the neocons played a very important role within it. But it would be folly, I think, to think that the invasion represented a deep aberration from the pattern of American foreign policy, either across the 20th century or even across the last two decades. The United States committed to an aggressive military and economic expansion in 1992. That aggressiveness was behind what the first Gulf War, the containment of Saddam Hussein, and the abandonment of containment as a policy. What the Democrats are finding out now is that the problem is not this or that ally getting this or that local elite to back you. The problem is the days of actually occupying a country and trying to transform it are over. It's not going to work again. This was an experiment that they were willing to countenance. They were willing to let the neocons try it out and take the blame, and that experiment has failed. Nor should we assume that in the aftermath of the election, when there's a new Democratic president, and I think the next president will most likely be a Democrat, so I think it's almost certain, all the signals are going out now that don't expect a change. In the debate 2 days ago, this is quite remarkable. Until now, the question had been, will you bring the troops back home? And they had waffled on it. Now the question is, by the end of your first term, will you bring the troops back? And they refuse to commit to that. This is not simply because, well, the Republicans have created a reality and we have to now live with it. It's because the Democrats recognize that what is at stake in Iraq is of fundamental importance for the American ruling class. And while there might have been some waffling on the issue before they went in, now that the die is cast, you don't get out. You stay as long as you have to ensure your control over the oil, to ensure American hegemony in the region, and to make sure that what is called credibility is maintained. And credibility basically means if people get out of line in the region, they know that we will come in and we will kick their ass. It may not be through an occupation, but we will bomb the hell out of you. So that being the case, I'll conclude now. The question is, if it is indeed true that we should not expect much from the Democrats when they come into power, and obviously not from the Republicans, what kind of constraints are there for people who worry about the effects of American imperialism on the rest of the world? Well, one constraint is the rest of the world, and they didn't think it would be one, but it turned out to be one. But the other one is domestic. And what 9/11 did was it took power away from us. It wasn't much, but it was something. And it was enough to make them worry about us. The conundrum, the problem for us now, and here we can think back to what Harvey Goldberg used to lecture about. If we think of where we are now to where we were 100 years ago, that is the left. 100 years ago, the general political culture in the United States was not one that objected to or had deep reservations about military and economic adventures abroad, about the use of American power to destroy and to overturn regional economies, regional cultures. But there was some kind of political organization. There was a political organization that represented an anti-imperialist agenda in Europe. After the fall of the Second International, Lenin's chief contribution, in my view, to world socialism was that it brought anti-imperialism into the very core of what it means to be a socialist. It wasn't before the collapse of the Second International. Anti-imperialism was not a consistently held position. It was within the Third International. And for much of the first part of the 20th century, organized left-wing movements were also anti-imperialist movements. Well, what happened in the closing decades of the 20th century was interesting. the level of political organization of the left simply collapsed, especially in the United States. It simply collapsed. But there was a very deep cultural transformation, and largely due to your generation. Because of the movements of the 60s and 70s, there is now in American culture, as a matter of public opinion, a deep suspicion and disapproval of the use of American force abroad. The dilemma is it has no political voice. The Democratic Party is not a voice for anti-imperialism, nor, for that matter, is UFPJ or any of these what's called movement organizations, which are really just nonprofits. They're not political organizations. And we're in a situation where the public opinion against what's happening in Iraq and the possibility of further American ventures abroad is very firmly and overwhelmingly set against it. And yet it is not making much of a dent on what is actually happening in policy circles because it has no political vehicle. It has no organizational form. So we find ourselves in a situation where there's been a tremendous cultural advance compared to the years that Goldberg used to talk about, but a massive political retreat. And that just then leaves us with this question, the question that the revolutionaries that Goldberg used to talk about, which is, what do you do? What is to be done? And I will not pretend to have answers to that, but I'll simply end on a hope, which is that the history of this country is one of a tremendous success against insurmountable odds on the part of popular movements. And it's come out of very quotidian, everyday efforts of activists and organizers. And I think at this moment what we can do is simply hold on to that spirit and that ambition on the part of organizers in the hope that we can not only scale back the level of violence and atrocity that's being committed in this country's name across the world, but perhaps even more ambitiously work towards what a 19th century philosopher said, which is a situation in which the free development of each is the precondition for the free development of any. Thank you.
Speaker Vivek Chibbers. His speech is titled Imperialism in the American Century.
That's a very good talk coming from somebody from a younger generation. Thank you, Vivek. I've got three quick announcements.
The military recently accused two attorneys representing Guantanamo detainees of smuggling underwear to their clients. Co-host Michael Smith and I will read two letters detailing the dispute, excerpts of which were reprinted in the New York Times and the Washington Post.
For regular listeners who are missing the presence of Michael Ratner, we have a message from him. He's trying to create a European Center for Constitutional Rights. He'll be back on the next program. But in the meantime, he sent us something with respect to Guantanamo that we want to share with our readers. He said he thought it was really funny. The involves underwear, and I'm going to read you an introduction to a series of letters on this underwear that's evidently been smuggled into Guantanamo. Undergarments from Under Armour, the sports apparel line, offer all-day performance delivered in a lightweight compression fit, end quote, at least according to the company's promotional material. While unprecedented in its ability to deliver comfort, Under Armour underwear is not standard issue for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So when two men in detention there were found to possess the contraband briefs, the Navy attorney contacted their attorneys. One of the detainees in question, Shakir Amer, whose release the British government wrote to request from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in August. But before turning to the larger question of whether Amir will stay or go, there's the question of what he's wearing. And at the recent exchange between the Navy lawyer and Amir's attorney, Clive Stafford Smith, illustrates, in the legal wrangling over detention, even details on intimates can lead to contentious debate. So with that introduction, I want to read to our listeners the letter that defense attorney Clive Stafford Smith received from the head prosecuting attorney in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Your client, Shakir Amir, detainee number ISN-239, was recently discovered to be wearing Under Armour briefs and a Speedo bathing suit. Neither item was issued to the detainee by JTF Guantanamo personnel, nor did they enter the camp through the regular mail. We are investigating the matter to determine the origins of the above contraband and ensure that parties who may have been involved understand the seriousness of this transgression. As I am sure you understand, we cannot tolerate contraband being surreptitiously brought into the camp. Such activities threaten the safety of the GTF Guantanamo staff, the detainees, and visiting consul. We would like to know whether the contraband material or any portion thereof was provided by you, anyone else on your legal team. And the reply from defense attorney Clive Stafford Smith is as follows.
I will confess that I have never received such an extraordinary letter in my entire career. Knowing you as I do, I hope you understand that I do not attribute this allegation to you personally. Obviously, however, I take accusations that I may have committed a criminal act very seriously. I also hope you understand my frustration at yet another unfounded accusation against lawyers who are simply trying to do their job, a job that involves legal briefs, not the other sort. First, neither I nor Mr. Katz Nelson, attorney for other detainee found with briefs, nor anyone else associated with us has had anything to do with smuggling so-called unmentionables into these men, nor would we ever do so. Second, the idea that we could smuggle in underwear is far-fetched. As you know, anything we take in is searched, and there is a camera in the room when we visit the client. Does someone seriously suggest that Mr. Katz Nelson or I have been stripping off to deliver underpants to our clients? I had never heard of under or more briefs until you mentioned them, and my internet research has advanced my knowledge in two ways. First, under or more apparently sports a U in its name, which is significant only because it helps with the research. Second, and rather more important, this line of underpants are very popular among the military. It would be worth checking whether this lingerie was purchased from the Nex, Navy Exchange Store, there in Gitmo, since the internet again leads one to suspect that the Nex would be purveyors of Under Armour. Perhaps you might check the label to see whether these are tactical underwear, as this is apparently something Under Armour has created specially for the military. I don't mean to say that this is an open and shut case, proving that your military provided the underwear, as I understand that other people use Under Armour. One group I noticed on the web were the amateur weightlifters, who seem confused as to whether Under Armour give them a competitive advantage. However, in the grand scheme of things, I would think we can all agree that the interrogators or military officers are more likely to have access to Messrs. Armour and El Gharani than the U.S. Amateur Powerlifting Association. Michael, in brief, what do you think happened?
I don't think they smuggled them in. I think that the hypothesis of attorney Clive Stafford Smith makes more sense, that they were purchased there and maybe given to the detainees by one of their guards.
So do you think that the guards were doing a favor to the inmates?
Yeah.
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 Nice.
Which is the usual setup in prisons, isn't it? Guards smuggling and everything for inmates. Everything from liquor to drugs to women to knives. I mean, we know what goes on in prisons. And why should Guantanamo be
any different
than any other prison?
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.